This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. When former Bloomington Alderman Mike Matika voted on the Coliseum contract more than a decade ago, he says the city manager gave him assurances receipts would be transparent. 3 months later, that changed.
And I was told, oh, that's proprietary. You're not allowed to see that. We're not allowed to see that. And I thought, well, that's a direct contradiction.
GLT's Ryan Denham explores missed opportunities to know more as an alleged Coliseum theft scandal continues to unfold. Find out if Donald Trump has what it takes to be a good executive manager. GLT's Judy Valente asks around. Hear how you can get solar power questions answered. There's a tour of solar-powered homes this weekend. And discover what it takes to be Miss Gay Illinois. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's October 5th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The investigation into mismanagement at the U.S. Cellular Coliseum raises the question, why didn't the city realize what was going on? GLT has learned that the alleged fraud scheme took advantage of a known blind spot in the city of Bloomington's oversight of arena finances, exploiting a decade-long contract that many city leaders disliked from the very beginning. Yet it wasn't just a murky contract that opened the door for the possibility of fraud. GLT found a lack of scrutiny by Bloomington leaders, even as others raise concerns about alleged food and beverage skimming that's now at the heart of the criminal investigation. GLT's Ryan Denham has the story.
I was not at all surprised. I was a little surprised and alarmed at the charges, the seriousness of the charges, and the number of charges.
That's former Alderman Judy Stearns, who served in the Bloomington City Council from 2007 to 2015.
But that things were not running, you know, the way they should was perfectly obvious to me in 2014.
Five former managers at the Coliseum, now called Grossinger Motors Arena, have pleaded not guilty to 111 counts of theft, fraud, money laundering, and other charges. They're accused of an elaborate scheme to skim off concession fees, overbill for cleaning supplies, and disguise other charges. Exact figures are not known. The charges indicate theft of around $1 million. Facing the bulk of the charges is John Butler, owner of Central Illinois Arena Management, or SIAM, which ran the Coliseum from 2006 to 2016, and he ran its in-house food and beverage company, BMI Concessions. The other four co-defendants worked for SIAM and BMI as well. The indictments capped a 16-month Illinois State Police investigation that began in 2016 after the new Coliseum managers, Venue Works, noticed alleged financial discrepancies and alerted the city. Former Bloomington Mayor Steve Stockton, who served two terms from 2005 to 2013, says he was disappointed to hear about the charges, though he cautioned that the defendants are innocent until proven guilty.
You know, the Coliseum was created under the mayor before me, but during my 8 years, of which all but one or two, the Coliseum was operating. My mission was to make it work, to bring entertainment to the area, and more importantly, to hopefully make a profit. We did have an operating profit for a couple of those years, but might have done better if there was an additional $1.1 million coming into the city.
Many of the criminal charges relate to BMI, the food and beverage company. Prosecutors say BMI was illegally keeping tens of thousands of dollars in commissions owed to the city as profit. The defendants were allegedly doing this using what they called the Kelly discount, an apparent reference to Kelly Klein, the Coliseum's now indicted former assistant general manager for finance. If true, a scheme like this might be difficult for the city to uncover. GLT has learned the city did not perform annual audits on BMI concessions as it did with the Coliseum itself. City officials told GLT that they had limited visibility into granular food and beverage sales figures. Former Alderman Mike Matika, a Coliseum supporter who lost his re-election bid in 2007, said he asked then-city manager Tom Hamilton during contract negotiations whether the city would have full access to Coliseum financials.
Are we going to be able to see every piece of accounting,
You know, food service, sales, beverages, every piece of the economic puzzle here.
Hamilton told him yes, Matika says. But when the venue's first quarterly report was released, that granular data was not included.
And I was told, oh, that's proprietary. You're not allowed to see that. We're not allowed to see that. And I thought, well, that's a direct contradiction to the question I had asked when we signed the contract. And that just always sticks in my mind because initial concern I had just because of the controversy around the building that we really had to have total community transparency in that process.
Hamilton could not be reached for comment. In response to questions from GLT this week, the City of Bloomington issued a brief statement. Quote, we are aware there are many questions about the criminal charges related to the arena. In time, we believe all of these questions will be answered and addressed. Until that time, we ask for the continued patience of the public, the city says. The city goes on, quote, the possibility of fraud and collusion can never be eliminated entirely from any organization or business, but the city has taken affirmative steps to mitigate the reoccurrence of similar allegations and will continue to do so. A city spokesperson said that examples of those affirmative steps include the city now having access to the arena's QuickBooks, as well as having a contract administrator on staff to spearhead contract compliance. The Food and Beverage Commissions were at the core of a lawsuit filed in 2014 by McLean County blogger Diane Benjamin, whose reporting alleged some of the same crimes laid out in the criminal case. In that lawsuit, Benjamin sought detailed financial records and salary information from the Coliseum. Siam's lawyer, Bill Muller, told the city in a January 2015 letter that Siam should not have to release those records. He said doing so would hurt Siam's ability to book future acts, because performers don't want the financial success or failure of a show to become public. Muller wrote, quote, event contracts usually embody some of the protocols, customs, and practices of the industry, and virtually all of them require that specific financial data regarding shows remains confidential. Muller went on to say that all concession revenue is revenue of the concessionaire, meaning BMI, and the records are property of the concessionaire. The management company may audit and review records to assure the proper payment of all concession commission. The lawyer went on to say that he believed it was very reasonable to, quote, conclude that the disclosure of the detailed information would be an unwarranted invasion of privacy. John Butler's defense attorney, Steve Beckett, told the Pantograph this week that, quote, this case is about business and business practices and proper accounting of funds. My client has done that and done it the right way. Beckett and Butler both declined interview requests with GLT. John Butler and then business partner Mike Nelson created BMI Concessions in October 2005, a few days after Siam's contract was approved by the Bloomington City Council. The idea of running an in-house food and beverage company, in addition to general management duties at the arena, was spearheaded by Butler, according to a former arena official who requested anonymity. That relationship between Siam and BMI concerned some city officials, although it's something that other publicly owned arenas have done. The BMO Harris Bank Center in Rockford, for example, is managed by SMG. Its food and beverage company is Savor, a subsidiary of SMG. Former Alderman Judy Stearns had concerns about that lack of transparency that might exist with such an arrangement.
There just would be no transparency. And sure enough, there wasn't.
Former Mayor Stockton says that food and beverage is, by its nature, difficult to watch closely.
You know, there were hundreds of people involved in the food and beverage operation. We had community groups out there that were actually manning the concessions to make money. There's a lot of cash flowing through there, and I guess it is a perfect opportunity for somebody to say, well, let's just take a little off the top, as is apparently being alleged here. So, in retrospect, of course, that's 100% vision back now, but I can see where that's an easier opportunity than, for example, ticket sales, where you actually have a number ticket. They don't number hamburgers.
The city's 10-year management contract with Siam had a tumultuous beginning, as did the Coliseum itself. In an advisory referendum in 2005, 66% of voters said they opposed using public money for the arena, but that's what happened anyway. Those critics have maintained their opposition in the years since, with many who still wish it had never been built. Butler and Nelson, the Siam owners, were awarded that final management contract in October 2005. The Bloomington City Council initially approved a management contract with a different company, called Bloomington Partners, which included Butler and Nelson and other partners. The city eventually reneged on that contract, leading to a lawsuit. The city also brought in a third company, Bloomington Normal Arena Management, led by developer Larry Hunman. Despite legal challenges, Butler and Nelson's SIAM ultimately won out. Butler bought out Nelson in 2009, and Nelson exited the Coliseum management team. Nelson declined comment. City officials have had qualms with the SIAM contract for years. Here's Bloomington City Manager David Hales on WJBC last week.
In the very beginning, it was not a good agreement, but once again, you got to keep in mind that, you know, this is a, even these auditors who spent weeks, if not a month each year going over doing random testing, things of that nature, didn't identify these problems.
Records show that Hales and his finance director, Patty Lynn Silva, as well as former city manager Tom Hamilton, were all interviewed by state police during its investigation. SIAM and the city parted ways in March 2016 as city leaders pushed for more financial protections in any contract renewal. Venue Works was then hired and continues to run the Coliseum today. The original SIAM contract was, quote, very, very poor and put too much risk on Bloomington and not enough on SIAM, says former alderman Skip Crawford, a vocal Coliseum opponent who served on the council for 10 years, from 1997 to 2007. During the October 10, 2005 meeting when it was approved, Crawford and another alderman raised questions about not having enough time to review the documents.
There was a very, very poor contract in the first place, and that is what I see coming back to bite us.
If the contract seemed to favor a private management company, one reason may be because that's who wrote it. GLT has learned an attorney for Bloomington Partners drafted that initial contract, which was reviewed by a Bloomington city attorney and two outside lawyers representing the city. The contract's 10-year term was a sticking point for city officials. Bloomington unsuccessfully sought a 5-year initial term with 2 5-year renewals, sources tell GLT. Other publicly owned arenas have opted for shorter terms. The Sears Center Arena, owned by Hoffman Estates, began with a 2-year contract with its management company, later extending by 2, 3, and 5 years. SMG is currently on a 5-year contract with the arena in Rockford, and Bloomington's new Venue Works contract is for 5 years. In April 2014, then-Alderman Kevin Lauer and Stearns wanted the city to renegotiate its contract with SIAM, using as leverage its desire to change from a professional to a junior hockey team as an anchor tenant. City administration responded by saying a council work session would be held to discuss contract issues. Stern says that follow-up session never took place. Here's Kevin Lauer at that meeting on April 14, 2014.
I would really like to bring this whole issue back up and work it out once and for all. It seems like there's just an awful lot of holes that have allowed to exist over the years, okay? And I think this is a poignant point here on the operation of this entity. The people need to know what we're doing, okay? And we need to know what we're owed, and I don't think that we've defined that here. And so I'd really like to bring the whole thing up at once and get this clarified very, very soon.
Stockton says the council wasn't monitoring closely the food and beverage receipts from each event. That's more the responsibility of SIAM, or the city's finance department, or the city manager, he says.
To be quite honest, I don't think the city council was monitoring closely the food and beverage receipts from every concert. That was up to CM, it was up to the finance department, the city manager, and the auditors, more so than the city council. And I'm not sure that I or other members of the city council would have been very good judges of, well, this looks right, this looks wrong, or, boy, is there some skimming going on here?
Stern says that Hales and Mayor Terry Renner did not take her concerns seriously. Instead, aldermen were encouraged to be cheerleaders for the Coliseum, as operating losses fueled critics, Stern says. The arena posted operating losses in 4 of the past 5 years. Its larger-than-expected operating loss in 2016 was $670,000. It lost nearly $500,000 in 2015.
And the city took a strong position that council must be a cheerleader for the Coliseum, that it was council's role to be excited, to praise the Coliseum, and not to question. That was not considered good form, not even acceptable form to question. There were consequences, and they were serious ones.
Renner declined to comment, citing the criminal investigation. But in an interview last spring with GLT, as the city and SIAM parted ways, Renner talked transparency.
essentially what we're asking for are not unusual. They're standards that are typical in the industry. Now, we also made it clear that, yes, they are a private company, but if they want to do business with the city, then there are certain things that they have to agree to, and in terms of openness and transparency. And I don't think that they're trying to hide anything, but they held their cards too close to their chest, and that contract was not good for the city 10 years ago. And we have lots of contracts in the past that weren't good for the city, and moving forward, we're going to make sure that we protect our citizens.
Some may have assumed it was the job of Bloomington's external auditors, not its city manager or alderman, to stop fraud. The Coliseum was audited every year, most recently by Sikich. In 2015, the accounting firm Sikich did not find any problems with the Coliseum's financial reporting. The city's auditor gave the Coliseum a clean opinion each year, Hales has said. The city's auditors were unable to obtain all the documents necessary to complete an audit of the Coliseum in 2016 due to the state police investigation, which began around that time. In a statement to GLT last week, Sikich said it intends to continue to fully cooperate with law enforcement and the city regarding the investigation and the pursuit of justice as it relates to alleged criminal acts during periods, quote, we were retained by the city to provide audit services. In addition to the annual audits, the city also brought in specialized internal auditors, the Bronner Group, in 2015 to help review various Coliseum accounting and operational issues. Beckett, Butler's lawyer, told Pantograph, quote, the public needs to know the city is the one who hires those external auditors. My client and SIAM rely on those audits as well. The public generally misunderstands what an external auditor does for a municipality, says Ed Sipe, an instructional assistant professor in the Department of Accounting at Illinois State University. Sipe is an expert in financial reporting fraud and a certified internal auditor. That misconception has a name, the expectancy gap. An external auditor's job is usually just to confirm that a government's financial statements are reasonably accurate. They may run some tests to see if internal controls are in place, but the goal is not to find fraud, Sipe says.
It's a common thought with the public that they expect that auditors are supposed to find fraud, and that isn't the case. If they do, they will say something about it, and they will report it. But that's not what external auditors are charged with doing.
The most notable case of municipal fraud in Illinois happened in Dixon, where the city's treasurer stole $54 million over two decades without detection. The city of Dixon eventually sued its auditors and bank and settled for $40 million, with the auditors paying the bulk of it. That's rare, but it has happened, Sipe says. Bloomington city officials declined to say whether litigation against Sikich is being considered in the Coliseum case. Matika, the former alderman, says the allegations are very sad.
Because I think the Coliseum still has great potential to be an asset for the community, and these continual missteps in terms of management, in terms of the first manager that came from the new management group having financial issues with him too, but the depth of the accusations is actually pretty alarming when you think about the good faith effort that was made to really build a community center.
I'm Ryan Denham.
The five defendants in the Coliseum case are due back in court November 3rd. It's Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Home and business owners considering solar power have an opportunity to get an up-close look this weekend. The Illinois Solar Energy Association's Solar Tour is part of a national effort to highlight the growing use of solar energy. The self-guided tour is on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 a.m., or rather 3 p.m. Shannon Fulton is the director of the Illinois Business, Development at Straight Up Solar and the immediate past president of the Illinois Solar Energy Association. Shannon, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas.
Thank you.
Central Illinois stops are just part of an organized effort statewide, and that what's happening in Central Illinois mirrors what's happening across the country. How big is this thing?
Yes, the National Solar Tour is happening in every state across the country, and it's sponsored by the American Solar Energy Society, ACES. And in Illinois, we have over 130 sites on the tour, on the self-guided tour.
And 5,500 buildings in 3,200 communities nationwide. What are the typical questions you get about solar?
We typically get questions related to how solar works. Is Illinois a state in which solar works well because of our long winters? How much does solar cost? When will it pay back? You know, what are my state and federal incentives? I'd say those are the primary questions that we get.
Does it work well in Illinois?
It works very well in Illinois. One little known fact is that in the middle of summer, in August, solar actually outperforms in Illinois as compared to Miami, Florida.
Really? How do you think the conversations you have with people interested in solar might differ from those on the tour, those people on the tour that might have with homeowners who have installed solar?
The tour is a great opportunity for people who have been thinking about going solar, but really need that conversation with someone who's done it, you know, rather than a salesperson, for example.
So the homeowners aren't actually selling it to these people. They're just relaying their experiences.
That's right. They're sharing their lessons learned, maybe what, you know, how they're happy with their system, what they're not happy about, what they might have done differently. Often homeowners have, you know, spreadsheets where they show their savings compared to what their proposal said, for example. And so it's a really great opportunity to just see a tested system.
Do the projections differ much from real life application of solar? Those spreadsheets that you mentioned, is there a difference sometimes?
We most often see that these systems outperform our expectations year after year.
And what do you hear from those who have decided to go with solar? What are they telling you?
They are really pleased with the performance of their systems. They begin to watch their energy use. You know, even though most people who go solar are very much aware of their energy use anyway and the costs associated with that, they become even more focused with how can we reduce our energy use so that our solar system goes even further on our behalf.
And what about ROI? How long before the savings in electricity bills pay for the upfront investment?
We're seeing a great ROI right now, 7 to 8 years most commonly.
Mm-hmm. In looking at the short descriptions of homes on the tour, it looks like a lot of them are going, with solar for environmental reasons rather than the bottom line. Does that surprise you in any way?
It does surprise me that we're seeing that. That might be a difference between, you know, the timing of the tour isn't ideal for everyone. For example, it's right in the middle of harvest season. So there are a lot of, you know, this is a rural area, right? So there are a lot of solar installations that just can't be on the tour for one reason or another. But we see, by and large, the vast majority of people going solar because of the financial bottom line.
Is there enough solar out there to actually have an impact, either in Illinois or in central Illinois, on sort of being put toward mitigating climate change or significantly reducing carbon?
Well, every kilowatt counts, absolutely. People might be surprised to know that, straight up solar alone, the company that I work for has well over 100 systems installed in Champaign County and McLean County. So,
and that begins to add up.
It does, little by little. And that's just in the last year and a half.
There are a couple of homes in McLean County people can stop by on Saturday between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. Can you tell me about Heather Everett's solar installation?
Their installation is 4.4 kilowatts, 16 solar modules at 275 watts each. They are near Ewing Park. So this is a family who has gone solar.
In the heart of the community.
Right in the heart of the community. And they went solar as part of the Bloomington Normal Group solar program that ended last year. And their payback would have been within that 7 to 8 year time frame, and that 4.4 kilowatts is in the range of a typical system size. Our average size during the Bloomington Normal program was closer to 7.
So that's a typical system size. Can you contextualize that for me a little bit? Does that cover the average energy use of a home, of a typical home?
It very much depends on how much energy use, of course, that home has. It not necessarily linked to the size of the home. Mm-hmm. So for a 4.4 kilowatt system, might be able to, for the standard home, offset, you know, closer to half okay. of an energy usage. But for this home, depending on the efficiency, internal efficiencies of the home, it might offset more.
And what about Mary and Hank Campbell in rural McLean County? Not a typical home. It was built to be energy efficient, but maybe a fairly typical solar installation?
Fairly typical solar installation. Their system is 6.4 kilowatts, so that's getting up there closer to our average. 23 275-watt panels. They, you know, Hank and Mary are such wonderful advocates in the community as well. Very much involved in volunteer work, and so this installation was very much mission aligned for them. And they had the perfect roof for it, due south facing, no shading. I think they're just very, very pleased with its performance.
I mean, they're practically off the grid because they have geothermal as well.
They have geothermal. The house was built with very thick insulated walls, and they're very pleased.
You mentioned the straight-up solar group buy last year. Are there similar incentives now that could help bring the price of an installation down?
There are really strong state incentives that were in place then that are still in place today, and we're very much interested in running a second phase of the Bloomington Normal program. And the good thing, one of the other real benefits is with the Future Energy Jobs Act recently passed at the end of last year, the solar renewable energy credits, that's the state incentive, it's a production-based incentive, those credit values are very strong. The Illinois Power Agency recently published their first draft of the long-term renewable resources plan associated with the programs in the Future Energy Jobs Act, and the table summarizing all the solar renewable energy credit payment values shows those values being as high or higher than they were during the group solar program. Hmm.
There's a history of declining prices for solar panels. What about the prices? Have they stabilized? Are they edging up? Are they still declining?
We're in an interesting time right now with the Federal Trade Commission case that's being debated right now. And
what are the details? What is that case? I'm unfamiliar with it.
Generally speaking, it involves the potential tariff being placed on imported modules, and so we should know in November more details on the decisions on that case.
A lot of these panels are coming from China.
A lot of them are. That's right. And so this is a case that is vying to add a tariff on modules coming in from China, for example, and South Korea, for example, and some other areas. But if this case goes through and a tariff is applied, we'll see module prices go up. They're already going up right now in anticipation of a decision.
And in part also, aren't they going up because China is sort of holding on to a lot of these panels because they have a big solar push in their country?
They do definitely have a big solar push. But honestly, it wasn't until this trade case was announced that prices started to go up.
So how closely tied are the prices of panels to the decision to pull the trigger and sign on the dotted line for solar installation? Can incentives sort of mitigate some of that?
Incentives will definitely mitigate some of that. I actually see the largest impact on the U.S. Solar capacity being on larger PV systems, larger solar systems. So commercial industrial utility scale will feel the impacts of a tariff more than residential.
And a reminder again about the self-guided tour. Some homes in McLean County, more than a few in central Illinois, and it runs on Saturday.
Saturday, 10 to 3. For more information on where those homes are that will be open for this self-guided tour, go to illinoisolartour.org.
All right, Shannon, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Shannon Fulton is the director of Illinois Business Development at Straight Up Solar and the immediate past president of the Illinois Solar Energy Association. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Here comes the sun. Here comes comes the sun, and I say, it's all right.
Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Donald Trump ran for president touting his outsider status and his record, not as a politician, but as the chief executive of a real estate empire. He promised to bring business expertise to government. His young administration has now faced several crises, including rising tensions with North Korea, two devastating hurricanes, the rise of white supremacy, and the worst mass murder in U.S. history, and the failure to carry out his campaign promise to repeal and replace Obamacare. But how well does executive experience in business translate into success as president? How would a management expert rate Trump thus far as the federal government's CEO? That's a question GLT's Judy Valente poses to Richard Ringer, director of the Organizational Leadership Institute at Illinois State University.
I think it's fair to say that, you know, he looks like a real estate developer who is trying to learn how to become president. And I don't know how far along that learning curve he really is in many ways.
Let's talk about some of those qualities that he does bring to the job, some of that executive quality.
Well, I think that's a problem for him, actually, Judy. And I think that what was required for him in his professional role are really different set. There are different sets of requirements for him in a presidential role in terms of what worked really well in his corporate role doesn't work very well.
What are some of those things?
Well, for example, if I'm a real estate developer and I'm trying to build a resort or develop a block of an urban area or build a hotel, a convention center, an office building, I've got to negotiate with people regarding, you know, getting the land, getting the loans, dealing with construction companies. And if I have a bank, I'm dealing with a bank that doesn't want to lend me the money. Well, I go to a different bank, and I can play that game a little bit. And, well, if you don't want to give me the good terms I want, then I'll go see if this bank will. Well, there's only one U.S. Senate. There's only one U.S. House of Representatives. Where else does the president go if he can't find common ground with those other branches of the U.S. government? So the negotiation skills that perhaps served him really well in that professional life perhaps don't serve him as well in his public life, in his public role, because the needs and interests of those different bodies are completely different.
Well, I'm hearing a couple of things from you. One is that you can't snap your fingers in the federal government as you can in business and say, I want this to happen.
I think you're absolutely right, Judy. I at least in my perspective, that's one of the issues, is that he can't go anyplace else and negotiate a better deal. He has to learn to work with the government as it is. Things just don't happen because he wishes that they would. And part of the challenge I think that he has in terms of his management style is that I think there are some lessons that can be learned as we look at perhaps some of the mistakes that he's made and how they might apply in organizational leadership. And one of those critical issues is the notion of what we like to call consistency, predictability, and reliability, which is that if you're in a management role in an organization, that those who work with you and those who report to you have some reasonable expectation that your behavior will be consistent and predictable and reliable over time. That what you say is important today was what you said was important yesterday, and what you say will be important tomorrow. Now, certainly strategies and policies will change over the long term, but not without some in-depth communication explanation why. With President Trump, and in fairness, and this is not a commentary on his policies or his politics, but rather his communication style, there often is a lack of consistency of what really is important to his administration. Is it tax reform? Is it health care? Is it immigration reform? Is it North Korea? And all of those things are valid, but at least from my perspective, there appears to be a lack of real consistency. Of these are the real priorities that we have as administration. These are the things that we really want to try to accomplish. And until leaders and managers are able to do that, it becomes very difficult for other members of the organization to have some confidence that we can predict tomorrow where you're headed. We can predict next week where you're headed. Fortune magazine just a few months ago released a survey of chief financial officers, asking them to describe the administration in one word. And it was not a very kind commentary. And those words were chaotic, erratic, unpredictable. And that's a really difficult role for a leader, for a manager to be in when those who work with you, those who report to you, those who engage with you on a regular basis can't predict what tomorrow will bring, what next month will bring, not only in terms of your individual behavior, but in terms of your priorities, your policies, the things that are important to you, what the focus will be. And I think that's been a struggle for this administration.
The U.S. has never elected a businessman president before. I mean, it's elected people who have been in business right. and then went into public right. service. That would have been George W. Bush.
Right.
Does it say something about the difficulty in transitioning some of the skills that serve you well at times in business to government? Or are some of the issues that you just outlined, some of the weaknesses of the management style of Trump as president, just due to President Trump?
I think this is a style that he has developed over years and years and years, and it's very difficult for people to change. We've certainly seen signs of his ability to be more measured and more dignified in the role, his inauguration speech, the post-election speech. Then he's had other occasions where he's been that way. I do think you raise a critical issue. You know, a major reason that Mr. Trump won the election is that he was truly running as an outsider, and he appealed to those across the electorate that felt disenfranchised, disconnected. And his outsider, I'm going to drain the swamp approach was very attractive, and I think remains attractive for major parts of the population. But I also think it's very, very clear that experience is a really valuable attribute to have. And even if we look at the second President Bush, he grew up with a president. He had been governor of a large state. You know, he came in with at least some background and some experience in an executive role in government. The U.S. government, it is enormously complex. It's huge. It's diverse. It's tough to manage. And I don't know that anything can prepare you well for that. And for someone that lacked really any significant public service experience, I do think some of those weaknesses have shown.
Do you think that a businessman could be, or a businesswoman, let me say, could be successful as president of the United States? And what would that take?
I certainly think so. You know, in fairness, I'm observing the president from a long way away through many layers of information and reporting. I think learning to be a good leader, learning to be a good manager is possible for almost all of us. I think one of the attributes when we look at very successful leaders is that they are very self-reflective individuals. They're mindful of their strengths and weaknesses. They're aware of failures and successes. They learn from those experiences. They're sensitive to the feedback, both the formal and informal feedback that they're getting. But that takes a learning approach and an openness to feedback that I think, rightly or wrongly, I think we can fairly question whether the current president is open and sensitive to that type of feedback about his performance. And I think that certainly is, as an observer, would be a concern for me. Is he really willing to reflect on performance, on behavior, on his approach, and look for different ways to do it?
If President Trump showed up in one of your management classes or your Organizational Leadership Institute and you had an opportunity to tutor him, what would be the one or two main things that you would instruct him on?
The first one would be don't pick battles with people whose help you need. Judy, we have so much evidence that successful leaders and organizations are able to build really effective cooperative relationships across organizations, including with people that they don't actually manage, people that they can't command and control, so to speak. And those relationships are built on trust and credibility. They're mutually beneficial. And whether you like people or not, whether you would be friends with them or not, there's an issue of building really effective relationships with those individuals. And one of the rules is don't pick fights with people. And through his tweets frequently and through his public statements, he appears to react very emotionally to disappointment, to the sense that others have let him down. And he makes those public.
Richard Ringer is the director of the Organizational Leadership Institute at Illinois State University. He spoke with GLT's Judy Valente. Ringer says another problem President Trump faces is that Americans over the past 200 years have developed specific expectations of their leaders. Ringer says they want their presidents in particular to be measured, dignified, thoughtful, and gracious. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
I'm Susan DiGennaro. Like you, I'm part of many organizations. My GLT contribution also makes me part of the community who believes in substance over soundbites. My community is one that is interested in investigating factual news, good discussions and debate that help me think critically about issues that impact you and your children. Your contributions ensure that you get to those issues. Join the GLT community and renew your financial commitment or make a first-time contribution. Click on Donate at WGLT.org.
Everyone who uses this public radio station needs to contribute. That includes you. GLT is only here for you because listeners like you do their part year in and year out to help pay for the programs they rely on. You need to do the same. Please help pay for the GLT and NPR programs you value. Make your first-time contribution now at WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It takes more than sequins, false eyelashes, and dazzling smiles to make a pageant queen. It also takes talent, poise, and the ability to do anything in high heels, which is pretty tough when you're a dude. As area drag performers get ready for their moment in the spotlight, Laura Kennedy has more on the demands and creativity of drag pageants.
The glitz and glam of the drag pageant world comes to the Twin Cities this Friday with the preliminary competition of the Miss Gay Illinois US of A pageant. Local drag queen Sharon Sharalike is the regular host of Drag Nights at the Bistro in downtown Bloomington. Sharon and her husband Michael recently decided to take the plunge into the world of drag pageants, acquiring the franchise of the Miss Gay Illinois US of A pageant. Sharon Sharalike says the difference between a regular pageant and a drag show pageant is, well, not much.
It's pretty much like a female pageant. There's different categories, and it's just like the best queens are competing in evening gown, talent, and interview. So those are the three categories in the US of A system.
Yeah, so it's very, very much something that we've sort of been raised on to expect with regards to a pageant.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. Well, Michael, why did you guys decide to purchase the franchise for this particular pageant?
There's some historical significance, as Sharon is a former reigning title holder for that system.
From 2000, and you were runner-up? You were runner-up in 99.
I was 12 years old.
You were! The youngest winner ever.
You have to be 21, sorry.
And then I think it came about because this year, one of Brad's drag daughters was Miss Gay Illinois, US of A, and mm-hmm. she went to the national competition, and it was there that we learned that the franchise for Illinois might be available.
And previously it had been held in Rock Island?
Yes.
Yeah, it seemed like a challenge, seemed fun to do. We have a lot of experience in that area, thanks to Sharon's
work at the Bistro.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And yep. organizing the charity drag show every year at Illinois State University.
Yep, and then I'm working at Wesleyan, too, and so a lot of different shows going on around the area. But yeah, I love the ISU Pride Show. That's a lot of fun every year.
What is involved in putting together a pageant?
There's a lot. Michael's been doing a lot of the online stuff. We had to do like a web page and set that all up with the history of the pageant. Anybody can go to that now and see it. It's IllinoisUSofA.com. And then we have to try to get prelims happening around Illinois. So I just contacted a lot of bars, and I know a lot of them because I do shows there, and I contacted the bar owners and tried to encourage them to do a prelim for us. And what that means is they'll have their own pageant at their bar, and then they'll send two winners. The first alternate and the winner will come and compete then at Miss Illinois.
And this is statewide that this is going
yes,
on?
Yes, yes. And right now we have four prelims that are starting, and then obviously some more in the works, but so that's what we have so far. We have a Miss Peoria, Miss Springfield, Miss Bloomington, of course, and then Miss Rockford they just signed on. So, and we're trying to get some more prelims going, but so at least we know we're going to have eight really strong contestants. And the good thing about doing the prelims is you end up with the best contestants, you know, in the area, because they've already gone through the evening gown, the talent, and the categories that they needed to do. And so now when they come to Illinois, they're more prepared to compete.
Which is great for the audience, because then you're treated to a wonderful show at the same time.
Exactly.
Well, how do you think audiences in Bloomington Normal are going to react to having this pageant here? Will it be at the Bistro?
Yeah, I think this first year we're going to do it at the Bistro. Next year, the Bistro will be celebrating 25 years in service, so we felt like that was a really good chance for us to come together and have the pageant there in celebration of their 25 years. But I think we're going to have a great turnout. The public seems to be really going for it and excited about it. It's a really fun thing. It's a great night out.
Michael, do you think that this will be part of drag tourism? Do drag shows really and drag pageants really draw in audiences from a wide area?
There is definitely an audience for this type of competition. If you go to the final night in nationals, there are people from all over the United States, not only people that are there because they're rooting for their favorite or their, you know, local hometown person that's now competing, but people that just enjoy the spectacle and the competition aspect of it. So there is sort of a built-in crowd for this type of thing. I think as a whole, you just see more people interested in the art of female illusion, as evidenced by RuPaul's Drag Con that's now had 3 years. It's doubled in size every year. And a lot of the attendees of that convention are people that are fans of the show. There's obviously a lot of drag queens and vendors, but I think the bulk is people that are interested and enjoy drag as an art form. So I think there may be a potential for drag tourism.
RuPaul's Drag Race started about 10 years ago on Logo and has gradually been building up an audience. And just this last season, they actually aired the season on a sister channel, VH1, which of course has a much higher profile. And now the show has a huge handful of Emmy nominations. It's really moved into the mainstream. How do you think this might impact drag and drag pageants?
It's interesting because RuPaul's Drag Race, the winners now are becoming like movie stars almost, you know, and they can draw in huge crowds. At the same time, they're charging a lot more to perform. They're able to do that because they bring in such a large crowd. And that's kind of happening, too, with the drag pageants. The winners now can go out and perform and draw in larger crowds, you know, than someone that you don't really know. For instance, at Miss Illinois, we'll have Roxy Hart. And she's a really well-known drag queen in the pageant system. She's been performing I think she started back in the 80s performing. She's a fantastic dancer, and it's a chance, you know, for people who aren't used to that caliber of a performer. They get to see her at the Bistro at Miss Illinois. And also, Miss Illinois is a prelim to the Nationals, which are in Dallas, Texas. So once again, we're getting the best queens to be able to go to Dallas and represent Illinois.
What makes a good drag pageant contestant?
Well-rounded, very polished in all areas. Someone who is well-spoken, who has their act together in every respect. I've seen some performers just personally that are standout in one area. They're amazing at talent, for example, but they don't bring the entire package with the other categories. It's really someone who fires on all cylinders and is excellent in all the categories, which makes them so exciting to watch.
And for Miss Illinois, we're looking for someone who actually does want to represent Illinois and to help build the Illinois system. A lot of times, you might get a winner that's just kind of using the pageant in order to get to nationals, and that's really not what we're looking for. You know, we definitely want somebody that's going to work here with us in Illinois and help to grow the system.
Well, how important is it to win the title? I mean, can it really make a huge impact on a drag artist's career?
Definitely, yeah. Because I won Miss Illinois back in 2000, you know, I can always use that title, not only in, like, what I charge as a fee to perform, but also, you know, it looks great on a poster, you know, when a bar can say we have Miss Illinois, US of A coming. It looks a lot better than not having a title. So it just shows that you've put in the time and that they know that you're going to come prepared and be a really good performer.
And I think probably also it gives you a networking opportunity. When you go to the national pageant, you encounter other like-minded people that you might not because of restrictions of your geography normally, but you now have a network and support system that you can ask for advice. You can, you know, work together to put together bookings or shows.
Yeah.
So I think there's, you know, beyond the financial aspect, there's also a community aspect to winning.
Well, how does the US of A system stack up against the other pageants that are out there?
I think they're probably about the largest pageant. I mean, there's different pageants for different types of queens. The US of A system is for people who were born male and are still male, and they're just drag queens. Now, they can have, like, face work done and even body silicone and stuff like that, but for the most part, it's geared toward guys who dress in drag.
Different systems are kind of known for different things. So US of A, I think, is all about a well-packaged, professional, impressive drag queen on all levels. There are other systems that are more about entertainment. So talent, there's one called, I think, Entertainer of the Year, and that seems very focused on talent. So that is your primary objective with winning that pageant, is being an amazing entertainer, but maybe the other categories are not so important. There are others that are purely focused, I think, on like physical beauty.
Like Miss Continental, it's held in Chicago, and that pageant is more geared toward trans, you know, the whole image and body and all of that. It's more geared toward that. But everybody's welcome in the pageants, but they just seem to be geared more in different directions.
Are the pageants a good launching pad to perhaps get on RuPaul's Drag Race and find a national television audience?
I think it can be. There are always contestants that are on RuPaul's Drag Race that have come up through the pageant circuit. And on RuPaul's Drag Race, the queens will kind of self-identify.
I'm a pageant queen.
Exactly.
Yeah, pageant queen.
And you will always, they will always tell you who they are. But with that, they come with a certain set of skills and talents that maybe some of the other queens don't have, because they have put in the hours, they are prepared to be professional, to respond to interviews, type questions.
And definitely good at competition.
Right.
You know, a lot of the queens on there aren't used to competing with each other, you know, and when you go through a pageant system, you really learn how to compete.
Sharon Sharalike and her husband Michael spoke with GLT's Laura Kennedy. Sharon Sharalike's own drag daughter, Heavenly Rose Sharalike, is the reigning 2017 Miss Gay Illinois US of A, and she'll be appearing tomorrow night at the prelim. Other prelims will be held in Peoria and Springfield before the statewide competition to crown the 2018 Miss Gay Illinois on February 24th at the Bistro. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the full Sound Ideas podcast and individual stories and interviews at our website. We want to know what you think of the show. Tweet about it. Use the hashtag SoundIdeas. I'm @Mike McCurdy. We're all @WGLT News.